Support for WERU comes from our listeners and from Maine Seacoast Mission, empowering youth, promoting health, and supporting community on Maine's islands and on the coast, lighting the way by land and sea for over 110 years. Seacoastmission.org.
It's just a little bit before 10 o'clock. That's Pet Sounds 2.0 time. Let's take a quick look at the weather here. Areas of fog before 1 p.m., otherwise partly sunny with a high near 51 degrees. Light south winds increasing to 5 to 9 miles an hour in the morning. Patchy fog after 9, otherwise mostly cloudy with a low around 36. West winds 5 to 10. Friday, rain likely, mainly afternoon. Mostly cloudy with a high near 46. Light and variable wind. Chance of precipitation is 70%. New precipitation will be less than a tenth of an inch. And let's see. Friday night, drizzle with rain. 70% likely. Saturday night's interesting. There's a chance of some thunder showers, I heard, somewhere along the line. Don't see that written here. Maybe they've changed their minds about that. Winter Funathon Pledge Drive is coming up Saturday morning, February 25th through Saturday morning, March 4th. Don't forget to support the programming that you enjoy and value. Call in your pledge. You can do that right now, 469-6600. Somebody will take your pledge. Or you can send it to P.O. Box 170, East Orland, Maine, 04431. But there will be a lot of folks here for the week from February 25th to March 4th inviting you to join the party. You're listening to WERU 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor at WERU.org. Stand by for Pet Sounds 2.
Good morning, everybody. This is Dr. John Hunt for Pet Sounds 2.0. We are again live this morning, two times in a row. That's pretty good. I want to remind you of my Sunday morning Pet Sounds original, Sunday morning at 7:30. It's about 3 to 5 minutes. So if you can't stand me for a whole hour, you can just listen to me for 3 to 5 minutes on Sundays. I've been doing that for about 5 years. We're going into our second year, Pet Sounds 2.0. And I want to remind everyone we are live, and you can call at 469-0500, 469-0500, if you have any questions about our topic. Today's topic is a continuation from last month. We had quite a lively discussion, and we couldn't cover everything. It's about dog sledding. And appropriately, dog sledding, a lot of the races are occurring now. I have one article I want to read after I introduce my two guests. We have returning this month, Nancy Salminen. Her husband, Dick, was here last month. But we decided to drag her sister, Lucy Leaf, here because she's another musher. And she decided to come and join us. Good morning to Nancy and Lucy.
Thank you.
Good morning to you. Nancy kind of told us how you got involved with dog sledding, but maybe Lucy can give us a little idea of how you got into this wonderful sport.
Yeah, my husband and I got into it back in the 80s, and actually before Nancy did. Yes. And Nancy lived up north in Maine, in Aroostook County, where there was that fabulous snow at that time, and we had to kind of go searching for snow sometimes. So we spent a lot of time in Aroostook County, but we started out in about 1984 or so with one dog, and then
a one dog sled.
No, we didn't even get into the sleds, but we went to a race and so we got a Siberian Husky, and then it was lonely, and we decided we get a companion. So now we have two, and it was me that said, you know, Sam, my husband, if we had three, it could pull a sled. And it went from there, and probably every musher tells that kind of story. And then, of course, it was, then we got another one, and then it was six, and then now we can really run. And the big jump was when I told my husband, and he really he balked at this. I said, Sam, if we had two teams, we could run together.
And how did that go over?
Well, he had to think about that because that's doubling, you know. And then so we got up to as many as probably 22 or 25. I mean, you're always raising some puppies, yeah, you know, to replace. And so they don't always go, all of them in training or going out at every time. But usually we were training about 18 dogs at one time, which is a lot.
And you're racing just one sled?
Well, actually, racing wasn't so much. We did races, but what we really like to do is wilderness travel. And we worked up to. We did some major trips in Labrador, and we'll talk a little bit more. We traveled 2,000 miles by dog team, unsupported. That was our means of transportation in Labrador. Up in Canada, about 800 miles away from here. Lots of snow, 3 or 4 feet on a regular basis. And we traveled by dog team. So we did races to prepare. No, just my husband and I.
It's kind of interesting that we focus on dog sled racing, but it's important to know, too, that it's just like running. You don't have to be on a track racing. You can be out in the woods just enjoying the whole experience. So dog sledding doesn't have to be racing. So if you're scared of competition, you don't have to do that. You can still be a musher.
Mm-hmm. That's what we like to do. The racing was sort of a means. It was a wonderful way to meet people, to learn about equipment, to get good dogs and that sort of thing. But for my husband and I in the 80s and the early 90s, it was all about doing wilderness trips in Maine. And then we went searching for places, and we found Labrador. That was a paradise for us.
Nancy, did you like that kind of sledding, or did you like the racing?
No, I enjoyed it, much like Lucy did. And the racing was quite secondary. But we like to support the races, so we did enter our dogs, and we were part of the whole racing scenario in northern Maine. But again, we would always refer back to our greatest love, which was expedition running. And just as you had mentioned, being out in the wilderness and self-supporting and enjoying what wants to come our way.
So there were no trails? There were no marked trails? So you're just off on your own on these expeditions?
No. In Maine, it's nice to have a trail. And we would use the snowmobile trails. And, and the big challenge is to try to use them when there weren't too many snowmobiles on them. Now, it's a problem in Quebec. They don't allow at that time.
That's right.
And I think it may still apply. The dog teams are simply not allowed on the snowmobile trails there. So we are kind of lucky in Maine. But there have been accidents, and so it's crucial to find the time when there's not very many snowmobilers out. And then in Labrador, since snowmobile was the means of getting around in the winter, there were lots of tracks and trails, but up there it's just a lot about. I mean, they just take right across the tundra. It's a whole different thing up there. And then we use sea ice a lot as well, which is a whole other dimension of travel and required a lot of learning. We did like to have the snowmobile tracks or just wherever they've been sledding. And a lot of times that depended on where the caribou were, because they're usually out seeking the caribou for hunting, and the caribou migrate. Up there, there's so much wind pack that a lot of times you could go pretty much across, like tundra-type country.
Mm-hmm.
The wind pack was crucial. And if there wasn't wind pack and there wasn't a trail, you could be snowshoeing and not make 5 miles. So a whole different scenario.
So before the satellite, what do you call those, the...
GPS?
Yeah, GPS and stuff. How did you not get lost? You depended on snowmobile trails?
We didn't have any of that.
Did you have maps? Or
80s and 90s.
Yeah.
It was maps.
Or you
it
stick your finger in the air and...
Map and compass. And we did rely a lot on the tracks, of snowmobilers, because there was a lot you had to know and, a lot of knowledge about traveling in real wilderness country like that. What's underneath. You're traveling on a lot of lake systems and rivers, and lots of rivers to cross, and sea ice and all that. So a lot of local knowledge.
Wow, that's exciting. Well, one of the big races that is coming up, I saw in the paper, the Bangor Daily, is the Can-Am Sled Race, which has been going on for 25 years. And you guys had raced in that particular race. But I want to just read a quote that gives the essence of you guys and the mushers and how the attitude you have towards your dogs. This is the director relaying a story about one of the finishes of the race. He said, I will never forget one year early on when we were all gathered at the ski tow around 2 in the morning waiting for the winner to come in. He said it was around 35 degrees below zero, and when the winner, Andre Nadeau, came in, he had a choice: go inside and warm up or continue to his truck, which is what he did, and spent the next 45 minutes feeding his dogs, bedding down his dogs, and making sure they were comfortable before he came inside to the warmth. Year after year, we get people like Andre in this race. And that was one of the things that came out last month in the discussion, how your connection and your love of the dogs, it's not a cruel thing. The dogs love to do this. You love to do it with them. And your respect for them is just is unmatched, really. So this was a quote that I thought was mm-hmm. very interesting. And they do have different races in the Can-Am, the 30, 60, 100, 250. Which races did you guys ran in this race?
Yes, we did.
Together?
Well, Nancy times? Was involved in the whole start of it in the planning. Yes. Why don't you tell them a little bit about that? way back in the 80s.
Yes. The idea was born through John Coletta. And he lives in northern Maine, had a dog team. And from there, the town supported his thoughts and created or birthed dog sled racing. It's very, very well balanced to have it in Fort Kent. The town size could support what is needed for the public to be in the area. And the college students are there to help with all the works that have to come in for the dynamics of setting up and putting down, and helped to transport dog teams to the front gate. And the town people were wonderful in establishing beautiful trails that were appropriated for just the race. So at the time that the race is on, there are no snow machines on those trails to the public. They're completely closed.
And that's respected.
Absolutely. It's well done. And from there, it just grew. Each year we had more and more teams that would come, and come from afar. They'd come from Canada. They came out from the Midwest. And yet it was also well balanced in that it was it was an invitation to young folks that are just starting in the sport and have only a certain number of dogs. Then we had the 30-mile race, which would be appropriate for them. When you race, you are required to take certain pieces of equipment with you, and so you have what they call a bag check. And in those bag checks are required pieces of survival equipment and food for your dog and this type of thing. And you take that in your sled and you carry it through the race, and when you come back, they check the sled again to make sure that you have that material still with you. So
some people would dump it so it'd be lighter sled.
Exactly, right. Exactly.
And that's
so it's well watched.
Yeah.
Veterinarians at each checkpoint, and the veterinarians watch for any type of dehydration or limitation or injury to the dogs. However, I must say that the mushers themselves are so worried about their pups that if there's any question whatsoever, as they come into the checkpoint, they're calling for a vet to come over.
It's a real collaboration. It's wonderful
absolutely.
To see.
Yes,
so they're not trying to hide anything. They're actually,
they want
the vets to come over.
Absolutely.
Now, if a dog is deemed unable to continue the race,
yes.
Can you have a replacement brought in?
No.
If you had 8 dogs, now you only have 7?
That's correct.
Right.
That's a decision that's to be
made.
You
drop the dogs.
And does that dog stay at the checkpoint, or do you have to carry him in your sled?
Well, what's it's established is, yes, the dogs can be picked up at the dogs can be dropped off at the checkpoints, and they'll be cared for by the veterinarians there. Depending on where the checkpoint is, if it's out remotely, then we will bring the dog back and deliver the dog to you under vet care. So
the race association.
They have elaborate mechanisms to bring dogs back.
So you know when you get back to the finish line,
yes,
your dog will be there.
And they're under care,
yes.
And they're, you know, it's
taken care of.
Very well monitored.
Yes.
Good. So
yes.
Then now you only have You have one less dog.
So you have one less dog.
Makes your racing a little bit different.
Yes, yes.
And they start with bigger teams anticipating they might have to drop a dog.
Oh, what's the percentage? Of
exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the likelihood of a, let's say, 100 mile? That's a moderate distance. What's the likelihood of you're going to lose a dog to the race?
It depends entirely on conditions. And
yes.
They can vary so much.
So you can almost anticipate, this is a good day, we're going to be all set, or
Well, there's certainly a lot that can come up.
Yes. Weather conditions, the condition of the trail. If the trail is soft and the snow is punchy, then you're going to have more shoulder injuries with your dogs because they punch through.
Right.
And they're going to tire a great deal more than running on a trail that is more groomed. And if it's colder, it allows for speedier dog. And therefore, your challenges may be more that of dehydration.
And you may be picking out of your group of 18
yes.
that day. If you know the condition of the trail, whether it's soft or whatever,
yes.
you may choose one dog over another. Or are they all the same to you in terms of some dogs are able to handle the crusty snow better than
yes.
another dog.
Yes.
I mean, you do have
yes.
that distinction. You can, I'm
yes.
going to put these two in because they're better at the crusty snow.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So just like a football team.
Exactly.
Okay.
We.
But you take better care of them than the football players, I think. They eat better.
That's fun. We don't know until the very last moment exactly who's going to be running. You will usually dogs, they bring more dogs than required on the race. And at the very last moment, if you have one that's not feeling well or one that's ill, you can leave that one behind, usually with a handler or with a dear friend. So the dynamics can change up to the very last minute, and we don't know.
So usually you bring more than you need.
Usually.
If you're going up to Fort Kent, you're bringing 10 dogs for a six-dog race, something like that.
Well, it depends on the length, too. I mean, you know, 250 would be different from a 30-mile. But even
true.
Then,
right.
You know, traveling is kind of hard on the dogs. You never know what might happen. They most of the dogs, by the time people are racing them, they've figured out the dynamics of who gets along with what. But fighting is always something that you deal with, hopefully at home more. And you have to sort the dogs out, who runs next to another one, and who's leading. Who, you know, all
does that change from race to race?
It could, yeah. And I mean, you're constantly
and some dogs monitored. Can be okay one race and then fighting the next.
Well,
or is there a certain
heat? You know, when females come in heat, that can really change.
Well, that throws
dynamics.
Everything. I'm not even talking about that.
Well, that's a big thing.
Yeah, that can throw everything.
We actually had all our females spayed. We just didn't want to deal with that. But you know, most people actually, you know, who are into breeding and such, that's a big one. That's a big topic of conversation that you'll hear about amongst mushers. But again, another factor.
Excuse me, Lucy. And then the responsibility of the dogs where they're placed
right.
on the line, as you had mentioned before.
Right. We're talking about the lead dog,
right.
the swing dog, and the wheel dog, and the point dog. We should probably talk about
yes.
that. Let's talk about that. There's
okay.
each position has a name.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you have the lead dog, which is he or she is it. I mean, that's the one that...
It might be two as well.
You may have two lead dogs.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, so how common is that, two lead dogs?
Most people have two lead dogs.
And
do.
Those two lead dogs are buddies?
Hopefully.
Yes.
I mean, you know, they will be with each other the whole
or
time.
Or sometimes an older and a younger, because you're always trying to, you know, train your younger dogs.
Do you test their leadership during summer training?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Constantly.
So you're always testing them.
Yes.
Yeah, and just seeing who's does every musher dreams to have the perfect leader, and that's what you dream about at night. And what is the perfect leader? And that will change too.
Yes.
You know, and what they expect of a leader, but And then we also moved our dogs around a lot because sometimes a leader will need a break. They get stressed just like we might. And we had a fabulous leader called Tom. He came to us with a name called just Tom. And he seemed to know how to lead from from a young, from 6 months. I mean, he taught us, even though he was just a pup. He just had it in him, and genetics, I think. And but that dog, he would be so perfect, and we almost called it telepathic communication. If we would think about, you know, going right, which the command is G, he's already doing it. I mean, it's just phenomenal.
Wow.
And sometimes anticipation is a problem, but sometimes my husband and I say, my God, this dog, watch out what you think. This dog knows what you think before you even say it. but then all of a sudden he'd get everything wrong. And we knew right away he's just stressed out because Tom just never got anything wrong. and so we put him back and give him a rest.
And he accepted that?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, again, you had to be careful who you put him next to.
But, right. So was Tom a good single leader, or did he work
he
well with
other
leaders?
He could do it all. Yeah. He could train the youngsters. He's a very shy dog, though. So, you know, amongst strangers and such, amazing. You wouldn't think a shy dog would be a great leader, but he was. I mean, the leaders come in so many different fashions. We could go on forever about leaders. But leaders make the huge difference on, you know, your safety, where you're going, how you're getting there, whether they will go forward in a blizzard. And, of course, when you get up into those really wilderness areas in Labrador, you've got incredible winds. And, I mean, you cannot have your dog team stop on you. You could be stranded. You're relying on your dog team to get, you know.
And the leader could just say, I don't want to do this, and everyone else follows.
And that's why we moved. That's why we started with Siberian Huskies and gradually went to what we call Alaskan Huskies, kind of a mixed breed. They were just so much more of a forward-going dog. And where some of our earlier dogs, they'd be wanting to mess around. They'd want to sniff. If they came across an animal trail, they'd want to sniff that. They want to pee on the trail, things like that.
Like dog stuff, you know.
Yeah, dog stuff. They want to play around. Yeah. And, when we got Tom, was our first Alaskan Husky. We put him on at 6 months age, and he was just a straight go-forward dog. And we realized, oh, my God, genetics is everything on these sled dogs. And you breed a couple of good leaders, which is what we were doing in our later years. And you got a whole litter of leaders. I mean, it was just amazing. And it just makes an incredible difference on, you know, what you have.
The lead dogs, my lead dog was Aspen. And their responsibility is to follow the commands that we give them verbally. And also they must be a fast runner, actually faster than the rest of them. Because they have to outrun all the individuals behind them, all the dogs behind them. If they were to slow down, they get run over by the ones behind
them. Yeah, they lead the pace, too.
So they have to keep the pace going, that's correct. And they also have the responsibility of listening to us. So they do carry a lot of responsibility to the success of what you'd like.
But don't they set the pace?
Yes.
Well, the dogs behind, you said, may run them over
if they start to slow down, and the other
wouldn't
dogs,
they slow down with them because she's the leader. Being the leader, if he slows the pace down because you want to slow him down, don't the dogs behind follow that lead?
If they slow down because they're tired, what happens is that there's no longer longer a pull, but the ones behind them move forward. And then before long, you've got tangled lines.
A mess.
The tug line has to be tight.
At all times.
The tug line is the main line that goes from your sled to the leaders, and then all the dogs are hooked on to it as they go.
The tug line you hold?
No, it's attached to your sled.
Okay.
No, you don't hold any line.
Okay, you're just gripping the sled.
That's right.
And you're standing on the back runners?
That's correct.
You should, okay. Mm-hmm. So your command is, when you're trying to control this whole thing. Does that have anything to do with it?
You have to lean on curves.
So leaning and then your verbal command to the leader.
Right. Okay. You don't have reins like a horse. Nancy and I were both horse riders before we were rushers. And you don't have reins.
You wanted it, didn't you?
Right. Actually, there's much more control of a horse than there is a dog team. And so there's two things. That, you know, hike means go forward. And you always want your dogs to have that energy to go forward. Because if ice is breaking out underneath you, boy, they have to go forward. And you got to make sure that there's that extra go forward in your team. They can't be so tired that they won't go forward. But part of that going forward is that the leaders, and one of the big things they have to learn to do is they always have to have pressure on the tug line. And that pulls the line out, and it prevents tangles. And tangles are a huge
problem. So he's trained. He has
it.
To know intuitively that this always has to be.
As soon as you put them on, you've always got your sled tied to something. And then the good leader, as soon as you put them on, he pulls that line out straight, and he holds it out while you're hooking up the dogs and everything. He holds it right out there. And a good dog, you don't even have to stand there and hold them or anything. He just right away does it. And anytime he feels slack in the line, he pulls that line out. And that's just crucial in preventing tangles and just that go forward. He's taught that from the very beginning. He's always pulling that line out.
Well, this is WERU 89.9. You're listening to Pet Sounds 2.0. Dr. John Hunt here, your host. And we're talking with Nancy and Lucy about sled dogs, our second show in a row, getting more into the nuances of the dogs on the lead, which is very interesting. So we're talking about our lead dogs. And also we are live, and you can call at 469-0500 if you have any questions about sled dogging and the dogs or the sleds or anything you want to ask about sled dogging. Dog sledding.
Either one.
Mushing. Mushing. Just please call 469-0500. That's Pet Sounds 2.0. We're talking about the commands. What is there a standard command, or do you have your own little language?
You can answer that, Nance.
Go ahead, Nancy.
We usually have standard commands.
We meaning all mushers?
No, usually you, the few. My
it's
sister
pretty standard.
And I, it's pretty standard. It's a hike on, which means move forward, and then you have your G and your ha and your wo. Those are generally the four major commands.
So hike on means you yell hike on?
Yes.
And then the leader says starts to go?
That's correct.
Okay. And then as they're going, what's the other commands again?
G, which would mean to take a right. Ha is a left.
Okay.
Whoa, stop.
Okay.
Good dogs.
A lot of good dogs.
Always rewarding them.
And they like that
always
verbal.
Always reward them. Yes, because they feel honored
to. They like encouragement.
Yes. Yeah. They like to know that they have pleased us.
Okay.
So, and we give them treats, and we enjoy doing that, and we give them breaks and make sure that they're hydrated. In our little tricks that we spoke about last month.
That's right.
And my theory is that if we can please our dogs and keep the sport exciting for them, then they will serve us well. So,
how long, when you're out in the wilderness, how long do you travel before you take a rest? You go like half hour at a time, hour at a time?
Conditions. It's all about conditions.
Okay.
Yeah. And if it's deep snow, or you know, you're actually having to break snow or something like that. It's real tough going. And,
so you go by how they look and how you look.
Oh yeah.
How you're
yes.
tired. Because
yeah.
it's on the race they mentioned something. There's what was the race called again? The Can-Am.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of snow and wind. And apparently a lot of trees had tipped over into the trail,
yes.
and then it snowed. And now you have buried branches. Now, I would think how can you tell? Yeah, you probably just see bumps. You try to – do the dogs sense it, or you have to kind of tell them to go to the right or left?
Oh, that's a fun time.
Yeah.
There can be all sorts of tricks when you meet a fallen tree. Sometimes they'll jump over it.
Oh.
Your sled goes right up to.
Oops.
And you spring down. Other times, if you see it's too large, you'd stop and you'd navigate to the left or the right, if you can, to get to the other side. And oftentimes you may have to stop and figure out how you're going to address this problem. You may need to take out your axe. Chop down a few of the branches to get by them. I believe, though, at the Can-Am race, they'll make every effort to be there ahead of the dog
That's
races.
What they're saying. They're
oh,
trying
they
to,
really prepare.
They're trying
yes.
to find all
Even
those
the
fairy
last minute, yeah. They're
yes.
doing that. But when you guys are out in the wilderness.
Oh, that's different.
Yeah.
Now, do the dogs, when you're on a trail, a narrow trail, and there's something ahead, obviously you're going to say, whoa, but do they kind of stop anyway? Or would they just plow right through it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, you have control. And one thing that might be worth mentioning about stopping is you really do need the brake on the sled to stop. And you need the conditions that you can...
There is a brake on the sled?
Oh, yeah, there's a brake, and they're crucial. And they even have little titanium tips and all this for ice. And sometimes we'll drag a snowmobile tread behind. What's really amazing is the power of a dog team. And even if you have three dogs... and a little sled, they are powerful. And any skijours will tell you that even one dog is a lot of energy. I mean, it doesn't appear that way, but you've got a real force there. And so you've got some mechanical things to stop that team as well. Just saying whoa wouldn't probably do it unless they're tired. If they're tired, they'll stop right away. But again, and then you need that tension on the tug line. So again, now when you stop and you get off your sled, and a big thing is losing your dog team, and it's easy to just step off and all of a sudden they take off. You know, that's happened to every musher. But we have, Nancy, what's it called? An anchor, the little drop thing. It's been a while since we've been mushing. So.
Oh, the snow hook.
The snow hook, there it is.
Snow hook.
We have one, usually two, and that you plant in the snow, and that will hold the team, but not... They can break that away, and that's why you might even have two. It's a whole big thing about getting it anchored just right. And then if you're going to have a lunch break or something, you would actually tie your team off if you could. And that's tricky because you may have to, you know, step into the deep snow to get to a tree or something and tie your team off. And then even unleashing it from a tree is tricky. You have to have special release mechanisms. So every aspect of dog sledding has there's plenty of opportunities to mess up. We can tell stories forever about our dogs' teams getting away, and then you're walking, and they can just, again, when they're used to pulling that line out, that's their job. You think, well, you could just call them or something, and you could if they're tired. But see, a dog team is—they're so anxious to go. You put all this conditioning on them. You could, to work up to 100 miles or something in a day, which is a lot, and you've got some really big power there. And so controlling it is, there's a million tricks, and we've all made a ton of mistakes.
Well, even if your attempt is good, like one time I was on a trail and wanted to take a break, I put the snow hook in and I secured it. I stepped down on it and I thought it had a nice hold. And I took the line from the sled over and tied it to a very small tree. And as I was anchoring that, then the dogs, I was talking to myself and I said, okay. And they were
off they
gone.
Go.
The snow hook did not hold. The line to the tree was fine, but they pulled the little tree out.
Yeah.
Right out of the roots.
out of the snow.
Oh, my goodness.
And I plunged onto the tree. So I'm getting a ride on this tree and my sled in between the dogs, and off they go. I'm getting a pile of snow in my face, and I'm hollering at the dogs to whoa, whoa, whoa. And I thought, well, gee, the sled now will bounce to the left and right, and it'll be pulling on its side, and also dragging a tree with me on it behaves like a brake. So eventually they do stop.
Only because it's so hard to pull.
Well, yes.
And you hang on to your sled as much as you can. So if the sled tips over on a corner or something like that, and so every musher that has experienced this, I'm sure, and so you're hanging on to that handle and you're getting dragged. I mean, if you'll do anything not to lose your dog team, you know. But so many of us have been dragged for, hundreds of yards and through the slush, through everything. And, of course, there's always a crowd around when you're starting. And, it's got hilarious stories. But that's all part of mushing.
Do you ever strap yourselves to the
sleds?
That does happen. There are mushers that do that, but
on a long race
it's
or
not
something.
an item that we encourage you to do. We don't think that's healthy. So
there aren't seat belts. And usually people don't ride in the sleds. You know, there's this idea that, you might take somebody for a ride or something, but mushers in races and all, or long trips. You're not riding in the sled. You're standing on those runners. And for people doing the wilderness running all day like us, it's all day. And you get off and you might run with the dogs up a hill or something. So you're on and off the sled a lot. But you're riding those runners, and it's kind of a moving around thing. And trying to stay warm, it's, you know, which is difficult.
So what kind do you have special coats and pants and like snowmobile stuff? Like waterproof or
Nancy.
What do you use for keep yourself warm?
Well, you multi-layer. You would use maybe the bibs that you use when you're riding on a snow machine, and then you place layers on the upper body, and then you would have a coat, and then you'd have a heavier parka, and then above the parka you'd also have a liner. And the trick is to have it very, very long. You know, my parka would go down to my knees. And it also could extend beyond my hands. So if I needed some more cover for my hands, I could do that. Three layers for gloves, my liner gloves, my heavier gloves. And then we tucked them into these enormously
pogies.
Huge.
You call them pogies.
Pogies?
Pogies?
That's the name of a fish.
They attach on the handle of the sled.
Oh, so you slip it. So
this is something paddlers, kayakers use. They attach... And so you can slip your hands right in them, and they're attached. And they're enormous. We could make them enormous, but then you can pull your hands out real easily. And you're actually holding the handlebar without having this great big thickness. The thickness is around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's built it's built in.
It's built onto the sled.
Your hands can get so cold.
Yeah.
Yes. It's very, very important that we always recognize frostbite and
On ourselves.
That's right.
You need your face covered.
The wind is crucial. If you're driving into a wind, you can get frostbite on your face so quickly. And so we had multiple layers of the balaclava, and then hats and a hood, and we like the fur around the hood. It could be fake fur just as well, and usually needed goggles if you're having to drive into snow.
Yes.
Well, what does the fur? I've always wondered, because I'm an old Parker that was the old military.
Yeah.
Back in the 70s when I wasn't going to college. Yeah. What's the function of the fur in terms of mushing?
The wind.
There's so much
wind. You can't imagine how much wind there is in a place like Labrador. And then the average temperature might be 20 below. And so that we're running, and that would be a comfortable, actually. That sounds pretty cold here, but 20 below, it's pretty comfortable up there. But you add the wind to that, and the 30 below and the 40 below, and the wind, it's you have to protect in any way.
So the fur kind of breaks.
So the fur kind of breaks it up.
It holds in your
And it sort of sticks out a little bit beyond your face. Right. So the fur made a huge difference, and everybody sort of had their favorite kind back then. And
Whatever works,
I think it's much more, the artificial. But, what you wear. But I wanted to also add that what really allowed me to run in a place like Labrador all day, like I said, we traveled 2,000 miles, and we were really in the wilderness, and depending on our dogs, and sleeping in a tent at night, somehow you've got to keep from freezing. But it was what really allowed me to do it was boots. We found these boots that now the regular pack boots that you see around here, my feet just so cold all the time. And finally, we found the best out there at that time were these. They were like mucklucks, but they were sort of modern mucklucks that breathe. And that's the trouble about the pack boots, that you need more in Maine because we have a lot wetter snow. But up there, it were kind of mucklucks made from cordura and such, and very thick, and a 1-inch thick foam. So they're huge, but they kept my feet warm, and they breathe. That's the crucial thing. They breathe like mucklucks, and then having the hood, kind of, all the multi layers around your face, and then at night we had enormously thick sleeping bags. We had about 10 inches of loft. Loft is everything in the sleeping bag.
Yeah, I think that.
And they had
insulation.
A company that's still there now called Wiggies that makes these incredible sleeping bags. And they're sort of heavy, but we could carry them in the sled. So just those kind of things made it possible. Like Nancy says, just layers of clothes.
One of the things you were talking about boots, and I saw this in two different places. One is in the article, and another I saw recently. The dogs are all wearing boots
now. Yeah, the dogs wear booties.
Now, is this something new?
No.
You've been putting booties on for years?
Yes. Well, before our major trips in Labrador, which lasted for between 6 and 7 weeks that we were out there traveling. We had our neighbors, our family. We sewed 500 booties to take with us on that journey. We only used a couple of dozen, as it turns out, because what you really want on a now racing is different, but on a wilderness trip, what you really want is the dogs to take care of their own feet. And so if you give them rest and they lick their feet, and I think it also stimulates them, and it's much better to have the dogs take care of their feet than for us to try to put booties on. Because if you go through a wet area or something like that, then they're all wet and you have to stop and change all the booties. That's a lot of booties if you have a 10-dog team, you know. So, but in racing, people tend to have them a lot for all different conditions. And then you might see a team like our teams. We didn't use them very much because
you didn't get those snowballs in between the...
Snowballs are a problem, but there's certain ice conditions that are really prickly to dogs. And another big challenge is fall training. We haven't talked a lot about training, but, in that November, December, you get that ice, when the ground is just freezing and the frost sort of sticks up, like crystals. And then you have to have booties on it. We had special booties for those for that time because the dog's feet will get abraded very quickly, and then dogs' feet. We're talking about dogs' feet. That's so important. They chap just like our hands chap, and so we're constantly putting on some kind of salve, and we're constantly looking for those cracks. And so there's a lot involved in foot care. And you might have a booty on just so because you're treating like chapped hands, for some kind of veterinary type treatment or something. So booties are crucial. Everybody's got them in their sleds. I think the race is required. That's part of what.
Yes. Requires a minimal amount of booties.
Right,
but now more and more the teams just leave with booties. They just put them on. They don't take the time to have their dogs clean their feet. So putting boots on, they can bypass that exercise, and they feel that they're doing the best for their dogs. And I think that's a good decision.
Well, also, races are so fast now today.
Yes, and the conditions of the trail, if the snow's packed, it can actually be like running on little icicles, and they call that corn snow. Mm-hmm. And that can chafe their feet, the pads on their feet. So they just go ahead and just put the booties on to avoid that condition from even beginning to happen. So
there was a question, I don't know if it's from a listener or from inside the studio, about Huskies once they retire. You mentioned last month that you loved your dogs and they retired and you had them as the pets. And I remember going to your house and seeing the pen and they just had a wonderful retirement. The question is, are there rescue programs for Huskies to be farmed out to homes after they're retired? And do they make good solo pets as a house pet? The sled dog racer. We're gonna stick to the...
They're all good questions. Each and every dog is an individual. So one may do well being by itself in a home as a normal pet would do. Others are better with other dogs. Most mushers, before they retire a team and find a second home for them, they're very careful about placing their dogs if that's what has to happen. They're very cautious about finding the home that they feel fits that individual.
Mushers usually take care of their own dogs.
Yes. They usually keep them.
I mean, you get so close to your dogs, they're like family members, and even though you might have 20 of them.
Doesn't matter.
I know a lot of mushers that will just keep, they'll have a whole retirement section, a whole pen of just retirees.
Did that. Yeah, I said, Nancy. No, these are my dogs. This is my family. They're coming, and they're living with me. And they did.
And like you said, the relationship and as you read in that article and everything, the musher always takes care of his dogs before himself. I mean, you'll see that. It would be very rare that a musher would come off a race and just turn his dogs over to his handlers or something. They want to be right there. They're evaluating their dogs. They're encouraging them. I mean, the bond is incredible. And the only musher I've ever seen that wasn't placing their dog above their own you know, welfare, so to speak. Right. I mean, you have to take care of yourself, too, obviously, to take care of your dogs, but is when they're hyperthermic or something and they're not really thinking clearly, you know. And, you know, in the earlier days, we saw some of this because I used to help on races a lot. You know, sometimes people would just that's why you have to take care of yourself as well.
Right.
You start, you know, getting hyperthermic and things go downhill very fast. So it's all related, but mushers are very connected with their dogs.
And they help each other a great deal.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
yeah.
right. If one's in trouble, well, then you stop and you stay with them.
It's a camaraderie. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you don't have professional mushers. You don't have do you have people who have a team and they hire somebody, like at a dog show, to run the race. Usually whoever's in sled is usually the owner of the dogs. And you don't have
usually.
A professional
Usually,
sure.
yes.
There are people. I mean, some of these top people, Andre Nadeau, some of the, you know, that you just mentioned, I mean, they were running back in the 80s and 90s. I mean, you know, some of these people, and they practically make a living. Most people that mush, they also do construction or something in the summer, you know.
Right.
But you see a lot of the same people. And they, you know, some of those people have run so many races. I mean, they know so much that apprentices will kind of work with them. You'll see that a lot,
oh, cool.
You know. But usually the handlers, as they're called, the team that, you know, is sort of back at the station, you know, taking the dogs.
So you do have handlers.
Yeah,
with
handlers
the
are called. And usually they're family members and friends or someone that's learning about sledding, you know, and dog sledding. But, you know, people don't really make a lot of money in these races. So, I mean, you know, you hear about the Iditarod and such. But, you know, with all the people in them, they don't do this for money. You know,
I
can't begin to tell you how much it costs to feed all these dogs, and your life becomes the dogs. And you need sleds and so much gear, and you need a truck to carry them in. If you break even, you're very lucky.
This is Pet Sounds 2.0. Dr. John Hunt, your host. We're talking to Nancy and Lucy, our sled dog enthusiasts. Going for a second month about talking about sled dog racing and just sled dogs in general. We are live still. We still have 15 minutes. So if you want to call it, 469-0500 for any questions you may have, 469-0500. I got more stuff to talk about. Just when you have the lead dog, you also have a wheel dog, which is... You have a wheel dog, a swing dog, a point dog, and they're at different parts of the order. So right behind the lead dog is what, the point dog?
Yeah, the point dog, right.
Okay. Yeah. And then between the point and the wheel is the swing. Mm-hmm. And then I guess my question is, once a wheel dog, always a wheel dog? Or like you say, is it interchangeable? Do you put... Depending on where they are in place, do you place your dogs depending on the strength, enthusiasm? I mean, how do you do that? Or is it just random? You just, okay, got eight dogs, just hook them up?
No, it's not random. You're always evaluating. I'll let you talk, Nancy.
Well,
you had wheel dogs, didn't you?
We all do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you can sort of call him, well, he's my wheel dog. He's my leader.
Usually, if we have a dog that shows he's a very, very powerful dog, and that's all the responsibility he wishes to carry, we'll have them placed in the wheel position, and that's closest to the sled.
Okay.
And they have different harnesses, too.
Yes.
So it feels different.
It is. The wheel dog is a very different position.
Okay.
Yes.
Does it have a different kind of pull? Do they pull the least?
You want them to be your strong dogs.
Yes.
Because they're closest to the...
Yeah, and then just the proximity of the sled to them, they have to kind of be a little bit more aware of where they are in relation to the sled and things like that. And the turning is different and everything. And it's just certain, we use different harnesses so they don't rub, they can rub, you know, the hair can rub from the harness. And so, yeah, there's some.
Plus, some dogs can be intimidated being that close to the sled. Because there's the sound, it's close, it's moving fast, and they don't like to be that close, in which case then you may want to put them up in swing or point even. But so those are where you were most powerful dogs. And then we talk about the lead dogs being in the front, and they're the ones that carry all the verbal responsibility and keep the speed and keep the tug line tight. Very, very tight.
Right.
And then we have the ones behind the lead dogs, they're actually potential leaders as well.
Oh, yeah.
And go ahead, Lucy.
Yeah, one person that ran with us said, gosh, your team, every dog could be a leader. And it was true. If we needed to give our leaders a break, we could take almost any dog. We could even take our wheel dogs and put them in the lead. They wouldn't be quite as brilliant as a thing, but they would do the job. They would get us to where we needed to be. And yeah, I think it's good to move dogs around. The ones that are in point, one time we didn't even know we had a good leader. We always had to run her right behind the leaders because she was a real annoying dog. She would bite the line, the tug line, and she's just a nervous dog. And come on, let's go, go. And you like that energy, but it was too much. She'd be biting other dogs. She'd be biting the line. And she could even bite if you didn't have a steel line, separate the whole team, and so off the front end goes, it's called. You lose your front end, and you know, there goes, you know, your first, you know, your leaders or your first four dogs, you know. And then we had to put a metal line there, and so she always ran in that position just because of that metal line thing. Well, we didn't realize that she had really been learning the leader role. And one time we were up in Labrador and looking for a trail, a very skimpy trail, and our leaders weren't doing very well finding it. And, you know, we kept finally notice it a little tooly, you know, she knows where to go. She knows where that track is. And so we put her up front. And, my God, we found we had this fabulous leader, you know. The pain in the butt dog that we had tried to give away that, you know, that fall. And she's such an annoying dog. She turned out to be just an unbelievable leader. So
we have a couple phone calls.
Oh, good.
First, Catherine.
Oh, yes. Hi
Catherine. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm just so impressed with the life that you have lived with your dogs. I'm just amazed. And the way you tell the stories, I just could listen to you for how many more pet sounds we're going to have on this topic. But the question I wanted to, well, there are two. First of all, my old husky's pads are drying out. I do give her flaxseed oil internally. But what is the salve that you recommend, and will she want to lick it off? And number two, how much water do you give them when you're out there in your wilderness trips? I would think you'd have to keep them hydrated, not just eating snow. So I'll just listen off the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine. So first question is, what kind of salve have you had success with keeping the pads moist?
We used Bag Balm.
Back then.
Good old Bag Balm.
Everybody has their own individual salve. But, you know, she mentioned about the water, and we should actually talk about hydration. That's probably the number one thing that mushers are concerned with, especially in races, but in every aspect. And we had all sorts of systems to keep our dogs hydrated. Do you want to talk about that, Nance, what you do?
I did last month. I'll briefly address it again.
We have a second.
And we have... What we did was we cooked turkeys and used the turkey broth to put into their food and maybe into their water, and just maybe put a little fine pieces of chicken or turkey in that, and they cleaned their bowls right up. And it just kept it a pleasure for them to drink. So
otherwise, they won't just drink water in the winter. You have to kind of flavor
it. So incentive. So the turkey flavored water, and then Bag Balm is the
That's what we used. I mean,
thing of choice.
As a
veterinarian, I didn't like people using Bag Balm for moist dermatitis, like hot spots. But for your case, this is the one time I'll say, and all my clients can say, Dr. Hunt finally said it. Use Bag Balm for the pads. Okay, we have another
on a healthy foot.
On a healthy foot.
On a healthy foot. Yeah.
Give us permission.
We have another call. Yo is on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Yo in Tremont.
How are you doing?
You've mentioned huskies several times. I'm wondering if there are any other breeds that are useful for sledding. Thank you for putting on this program, and thank you to everyone for supporting Community Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Yo.
Well, I had mentioned earlier in the show here that we started out with Siberian Huskies. They're so pretty. They've got a beautiful coat. And then we moved to Alaskan Huskies, which came from Alaska originally. They're kind of a mixed breed of animal, of dog, sled dog. But they don't have very big, heavy coats. And so we actually made coats for our dogs. And that's sort of the downside. But certainly you've heard of Malamutes, and they're very big dogs that have very heavy coats, and they really are northern dogs. And but you don't see very many on the races because they're not very fast dogs. And I'll let you continue.
They're powerful but slow. Yes. Yes. The husky. So the Alaskan Malamute is the Alaskan Husky is a cross of Alaskan Malamute.
No, it's a cross of a lot of different things, including hound dogs, even. So
So that means that we don't necessarily have to stay with a husky-type dog for dog sledding. I've seen many of them that are Chinooks. I've actually seen poodles. I've seen just a mixture of pleasure dogs that have come from the rescue teams and kennels.
Hunting dogs. We see hunting dogs.
Hunting dogs,
Samoyeds.
Yes, indeed. Samoyeds.
Oh, that's right,
yes,
Samoyeds. Yeah.
Okay. So really, it's just the desire if your dog would like to run with you. We've also spoken earlier in the show about ski-juring, and that's when there's no sled at all. That's when the person would be on their cross-country skis. And they would have an attachment around their waist that would go onto the line attached to their dogs.
With one or two dogs.
With one or two is what we recommend. No more than that unless you're a very, very good skier.
We got one more caller. We want to get her in, Sarah from Stonington, before we have to go. But just to reiterate with Yo, there are a lot of different kinds. The classic is the Siberian Husky is the classic breed that we all see,
kind of
right?
Well-known.
That's
yeah.
the well-known one. Uh-huh. Sarah from Stonington, good morning. How are you today?
Oh, good. I love your show. Thank you for doing
this. Thank you.
I had two questions. What's the coldest temperature you've ever been in out there mushing? And do the modern mushers now use, like, phones and GPS?
Okay, so the coldest measurable that you've been out that you know of, and do you guys cheat? I mean, not cheat. Use GPS. I would.
Well, in Labrador, way up north, we carried a thermometer in our sled on our wilderness trips, and it went off the chart,
under the chart.
Under whatever. I mean, it wouldn't even register. So, I mean, we have been out in 40 below, but again, it's the wind chill that just is the killer.
And it's also important to know that things like zippers don't work in cold weather of that temperature.
Oh, how about Velcro?
Velcro is excellent. Yeah. That's what we used. Yeah. Buckles can snap, metal snap, plastic bags just shred. So you have to think about what you take
water
up there
bottles
with
don't
you.
Open.
Yes.
And GPS.
Cameras don't work. Oh, the GPS. Yeah. See, we didn't have
seconds.
Any of that back then. So
how about now?
Now they do. Yes.
You can
absolutely.
You can have it on your phone now.
Absolutely.
I mean, your wristwatch.
Of course.
It's like Dick Tracy.
They have all that.
got everything.
I haven't been running recently, so I don't know anything about that.
Why not?
Why not?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk about kinds of sleds and stuff, but we ran out of time because of your interesting stories and background. Lucy Leaf and Nancy Salmonen are my two, along with Richard, Nancy's husband, expert sled racing people in the Orland-Bucksport area. I want to thank you very much for coming, and you have another story to tell sometime in the future about your horse ride across country.
Oh.
So that's another
another
topic.
Another life.
That's another life. Okay, well, we can spend an hour with that.
Indeed, you can.
So I'd just like to say goodbye to everybody. This is Pet Sounds 2.0, Dr. John Hunt. And remember, enjoy your pet, and don't forget to give them a hug.
It's about 3 minutes to 11 o'clock on the wing time at 11. Let's take a quick look at the weather while we can. Areas of fog before 1 p.m., otherwise partly sunny with a high near 51, south wind 5 to 9 miles an hour. Tonight, patchy fog after 9 p.m., otherwise mostly cloudy with a low around 36, west winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. Let's see, rain likely Friday, mainly afternoon, mostly cloudy. Less than a tenth of an inch possible. Friday night, drizzle with rain, likely cloudy with a low around 36. And calm winds becoming east around 6 after midnight. Chance of precipitation is 70%, so we will have some rain Friday night. New precipitation amounts between a tenth and a quarter of an inch possible. Saturday, drizzle with a rain likely, areas of fog after 3. Rain likely Saturday night, mostly sunny Sunday. So quickly, you're listening to WERU 89.9, Blue Hill 99.9 in Bangor, streaming at weru.org. We are volunteer-powered. We are listener-supported and a voice of many voices. Support for WERU comes from Waterfront Concerts, presenting their 5th annual Rise Above Fest 2017, featuring Korn, Shinedown, Stone Sour, Hailstorm, Seether, and more at Darling's Waterfront Pavilion on Saturday, July 22nd and Sunday, July 23rd. Tickets on sale Friday, February 24th at 10 a.m. 358-9327 or waterfrontconcerts.com.
Have you ever visited a salt marsh? These wetlands provide valuable habitat for birds and fish and help protect coastal property from flooding.